The decision to go to war in Afghanistan in 2001 and the one to go to war in Iraq 2 years later were, of course, defining moments in the presidency of George W. Bush. Another enduring memory from those years is that of then Vice President Dick Cheney supposedly calling the shots. But that's not the picture you get from Days of Fire, Bush and Cheney in the White House. That's a new book by Peter Baker, White House correspondent for the New York Times. Baker dismisses what he calls the cartoonish view that Bush just did whatever Cheney told him. In fact, he quotes one source as saying Bush was the undisputed alpha male in the White House. It's just that Bush agreed with Cheney on most issues through much of his first term.
You know, there's a striking change between, say, 2003, when President Bush is about to go into Iraq, and 2007, when he's asked whether he should bomb Syria because they have a nuclear reactor. And in the first instance, 2003, he meets with all his advisors. They've got intel about where they think Saddam Hussein is. And then he kicks everybody else out except for Dick Cheney. He just wants to talk to Cheney before he makes this big decision, comes out of that meeting and says, go. That's the beginning of the Iraq war. By 2007, he's asked by the Israelis to bomb this nuclear facility in Syria. He meets with all his advisors. This time, he asks Cheney to give his position in front of everybody else. Cheney says they should go ahead and bomb the facility, that red lines matter, and they should do it for credibility's sake. And the president says, okay, does anybody agree? And no hands go up. So this time, rather than just relying on Cheney, he's shown that Cheney is isolated from the rest of the team and forced him to kind of confront it, as Bush decides to try diplomacy instead.
I doubt there's a single moment, but do you think that that's kind of the beginning of the divergence between Bush and Cheney?
I think it's a series of moments. Yeah, I think that, you know, you could point to a number of different times when they begin to sort of head off in different directions. I think early in 2004, President Bush was not kept informed of a fight that was going on about the legality of the NSA surveillance program we're reading a lot about right now. Mm-hmm. And he was, I think, mad that he was kept in the dark about that. I think, you know, even Katrina, they were on, you know, different pages. The president asked the vice president to head up a task force on Katrina, and the vice president said no, didn't want to do that. But I particularly think, obviously, as Iraq just began to consume his presidency, he was looking for a different direction. He was looking to try more diplomacy. He was looking to kind of compromise on some of the more controversial programs that had been so disputed in the first term. And Cheney saw that as a dangerous divergence, a loss of will, and the two were heading in different directions.
What kind of relationship do Bush and Cheney have today?
Well, I think it's proper. I think it's respectful, but it's not close. I don't think they talk very often. I interviewed Cheney for the book. He said, we're not buddies. We weren't buddies. It was a professional relationship. They saw each other most recently in April during the opening of the Bush Presidential Library in Dallas. Cheney was there, and the president said nice things about him from the stage. But Cheney was seated in the audience with the children and the cabinet secretaries, and it was Condoleezza Rice who was on stage and had a speaking role. And if you went into the library afterward, you saw the way Bush wants his presidency to be remembered. And you saw exhibits on Iraq and freedom and PEPFAR, his AIDS program. You saw videos narrated by Condi Rice and Josh Bolton and Andy Card, a portrait of the First Lady, pictures of the daughters, even a statue of the dogs. But what you don't really see in his library is Dick Cheney. He doesn't really show up very much.
You know, one interesting insight from your book is the contrast between the severe doubts that Bush felt in private compared to the near swagger that he put out in public. It's a stark contrast to the mea culpas we've been hearing, especially lately, from President Obama.
Yeah, President Bush didn't believe in showing that kind of thing publicly. He took from LBJ's example of Vietnam a lesson that the presidents can't agonize in public, that if you show ambivalence in public, it sends a wrong message to not only the public but to your troops, to the enemy, and so on. So to the extent that he was feeling great pressure from the war, he tried very hard to keep that to himself. But in private, you know, aides said that they noticed that he sometimes seemed almost despondent in meetings. Things are going so badly. At some points, one aide said it was like he was kind of, you know, willing us to not give him more bad news today. He clenched his jaw so much that his jaw was hurting. His wife would try to get his brother Marvin to come visit on weekends to kind of take his mind off the war. You know, I think it would weigh on any president.
What continuities do you see between the Bush White House and the Obama White House?
Well, more than we probably imagined. I think particularly when it comes to national security and foreign policy, the continuity between the White Houses of different parties is much greater than we think. The range of options is relatively limited. In this case, President Bush had moderated and shaved off the edges of a lot of his programs on national security so that by the time President Obama came in, he inherited most of them and made some further modifications but didn't toss them overboard. He ran against Bush's first term, in effect, but inherited Bush's second term. So we saw an increase in the drone program. We saw the continuation of indefinite detention at Guantanamo. We saw military commissions and surveillance, which we're reading a lot about these days in the news, continue. So, you know, in effect, President Obama has validated to some extent at least part of the Bush program.
I mean, you're a regular at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, Peter. When you walk into the White House, what is the biggest difference that strikes you between Obama and Bush?
That's a good question. I mean, you know, what strikes me often is the similarities rather than the differences. I'm struck by here we are in the fifth year of a presidency. And once again, you know, you have a president in trouble. You know, the whole first term is organized around one thing, getting a second term, right? And that provides a president sort of an organizing principle and an end date, a goal, and a specific measure of success. Either you win or you lose. And on election day, both President Bush and President Obama could claim victory for a second term. Then you head into this fifth year where suddenly you're no longer running ever again, and you're trying to implement an ambitious agenda, and suddenly you find yourself frustrated. In Bush's case, obviously, it was the war in Iraq, and it was Hurricane Katrina. In President Obama's case, we see his frustration over Syria. We see the problems with the health care program and the government shutdown debates. And they're both, you know, at relatively similar places in this point of the presidency in terms of the polls. Now, the question is, can President Obama turn it around? President Bush had a hard time doing that. But there are lessons to be learned, probably.
Peter Baker, White House correspondent for The New York Times and author of Days of Fire, Bush and Cheney at the White House. Thanks very much.
Hey, thanks for having me.